to call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and we'd like to have somebody move the minutes right off the bat.
So moved.
Representative Heitzman moves the minutes of March the 11th. Any discussion? Any corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the minutes are approved. You see by your agenda, we have five bills today, so we're going to do some good work. We can find our first author. There he is. House File 384. The chair moves House File 384 to be referred to the Education Finance Committee. Representative Erdahl, welcome to this, the last committee of the day, maybe. I'm not sure.
Well,
for me, it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I do have an amendment.
An oral amendment?
Well, I have the, in my packet here, it's the A6. I don't know what your number is.
Oh, okay, we will pull that.
But I need to put in a couple of oral changes.
Okay. So I will move the A6 amendment, and you have a couple, that's where you want your oral amendment?
Yes.
And could you tell us what that is?
Okay. If it matches up the way it is in my hands here, on line 1.11, a school year long student teaching program, after program, I would like to insert the word pilot, comma, consistent with the student teaching program. So it would read student teaching program pilot. And then on line 1.14, instead of 2016, I would like it to read 2017. And those are the two oral changes that I have. Basically, the amendment, we give Minsky the job of compiling a pilot program in student teaching for year-long student teaching, and the Board of Teaching is directed to work with Minsky on that and to implement their program. Then there's a date change in the amendment on page 4, and then the Section 2 amendment is the one that establishes a pilot program for school year-long student teaching. And
all right, we'll incorporate your oral amendments into the A6 amendment.
And that is the amendment.
Okay, any questions? All those in favor then of the A6 amendment as orally amended, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the amendment is adopted to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Most student teachers in Minnesota now have a 12-week or semester course in student teaching. I believe we can be better prepared to teach, they can be better prepared to teach, and are less likely to leave the profession in their first 2 years with a school year-long student teaching program. In Finland, they use this model, and I propose to create a pilot program in Minnesota through Minsky. And there are some Minnesota colleges and universities that have expressed interest. This does not replace the current student teaching programs. It is meant to be offered as an option to those students who believe that it will work for them and for their situations. For example, let's say that someone was going to school at St. Cloud State, lived in Maple Grove, and wanted to student teach in Northview Junior High in Osseo. This might work for them. They could live at home. They maybe wouldn't have to have a job. They wouldn't have to pay rent, possibly. And for those types of people, this might work, whereas it might not work for other types, and they would still have the other option. There are places where this is working. Arizona and Indiana are a couple. The University of Northern Iowa is creating a model that I think that we can learn from. I do not propose this as another year of school. I believe that pedagogy and methods courses can be included within the student teaching framework. A year-long experience in a school offers a teacher candidate the unique opportunity to be a member of a faculty and professional learning community within their host school, engage in real-life teaching over a longer period of time, gain greater knowledge of school policies and procedures, have more time for reflective practice and experience, a more knowledgeable transition to the first year of teaching. Placement rates for year-long student teachers have been near 100%. So again, we create a pilot program in this bill to foster the development of better prepared teachers for Minnesota schools. Mr. Chairman, that's what I'm trying to do.
Thank you. That sounds like a good plan. Any questions from the committee? Representative Daniels?
Mine's not a question, it's more of a comment. My wife went back to school after we raised our four children, and when it came down to the student teaching time, it was very difficult to schedule her work around the student teaching time, and basically we lost her as a teacher because during the summer she took a part-time job in between student teaching, and that job turned into a full-time job, and she's very successful at it, but it did take away another teacher that would have been in the public school system. So I really admire what you're doing there. It's very much needed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have someone to testify on your bill?
I'm sure that most of the audience would like to, but I think we're fine.
You're fine?
Unless...
Oh, well... We're
fine. We don't need anybody else, unless they really want to
come. We'll invite them down anyway, just in case there's somebody up there, for or against. I guess they don't want to talk. They're satisfied.
They're satisfied.
That's
Thank
another
you,
way
Mr.
to look
Chair.
At it. So if there's no further questions or discussion, then the Chair will again move House File 384 as amended to be referred to the Education Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Oh, we need to vote on. Yeah. We're new at this. Okay. I have renewed the motion. Now you have to vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Now it's official. Yeah. Next bill on our agenda today is House File 987. Representative Seltzer. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Chair will move House File 987 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill. So
thank you, Mr.
Go ahead and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I also have an amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like to have it. If I could move that amendment, or with the chair, or
we'll find it here. The A1 amendment.
Yes.
The chair moves the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would you like me to just explain the bill, or should I explain the amendment first?
Briefly, the amendment.
Okay, sure. The I do have some experts here with me too, in case if I need to phone a friend. This bill is actually the first sunshine law of its kind in the nation to shine a light on the safety records of post-secondary study abroad programs. And the amendment adds some requirements to the original bill, as well as adding some clarifying language. So you see that on page 1, line 13, we're deleting program name, and we're requiring that the primary country that the student is in is listed. And then after line 14, we are defining program host, which would take the place of program name. So that would be defining what it means to be primarily responsible for the Experience Abroad program. And then on page 1, line 17, we're also adding hospitalization to the incident disclosure that post-secondary students must request but not mandate from its students that have participated in the study abroad program. So before I move on to the bill, I'm wondering if I'm open to any questions on the amendment, Mr. Chair.
I don't see any.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today, Mr. Chair and members. You know, I'm proud that House File 987 has bipartisan support. This bill provides further clarification
to the
bill.
Can we interrupt for just a minute? We did not vote on the amendments.
I am so sorry.
We should do that.
Thank you.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Now it's official.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue, please.
Thank you. So as I was mentioning, this bill provides further clarification to a bill that Senator Bonoff and I, with a great deal of help from Representative Pawlowski and others, were fortunate enough to pass into law last session. And as I mentioned, this bill is the first of its kind in the nation, and its purpose is to shine a light on the safety records of post-secondary experience abroad programs that partner with our post-secondary institutions. Obviously, most study abroad programs are wonderful. Our students go abroad, they learn about other cultures, they're wonderful ambassadors for the United States, and they bring home wonderful memories and experiences and learn a lot. Not all students, unfortunately, have that experience, and there have been incidents abroad, including illnesses, accidents, and even death. And I was shocked to find that although there are laws, and there should be laws, that protect our students who come from abroad to study here, there are no laws to even shine a light on the safety records of these multi-billion-dollar organizations that partner with our post-secondary institutions to send our students abroad. And so that's what this law does. And what, as you see, when I explain the amendment, we're adding some language to provide some clarity. And then also, if you look on the back, page 2, on line 2.5 to 2.7, we're changing the vague language of the best available information by country to some specific links that we want to be posted on the Secretary of State's website. And so, again, the purpose of this bill initially and still is just to provide information for our families and our students when they contemplate these experience abroad programs so that they can have the tools to make decisions that will ensure that they have a safe and wonderful experience. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. Any questions of the author? You have several testifiers.
I have several people who are here to answer, experts who are here to answer any questions, or if they do have something that they would like to add.
Okay, is there anyone that would like to speak to this bill in the audience? You've covered it quite well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. So if there are no further questions, do you have any final advice?
Well, just thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing this bill and for laying it over for possible inclusion. And I hope you'll make these modifications in the final omnibus bill so that we have an even stronger law that will protect our students.
Thank you, Representative. The Chair will renew its motion that House File 987, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill.
Thank you very much.
Representative Doblock. And the chair moves House File 488 to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And welcome, Representative Doblock.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House File 488 is the contract ratification bill. It ratifies six contracts that were not available for ratification during the last legislative session because of arbitration issues. These are the Minnesota State University Administrative and Service Faculty, Minnesota State College Faculty, Minnesota Nurses Association, the IFO, the Interfaculty Organization, the Minsky Personnel Plan for Administrators, and the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association, which is the state troopers, the game wardens, and the BCA agents and employees. And members, I know that this bill hasn't always come to the higher ed committee. Some years it has, some years it hasn't. I guess I had felt, and I think others had felt, it was appropriate for it to come this year since four of the six contracts that were being ratified were MNSCU-related higher education contracts. And members, I'm not sure how much more of a presentation you want on it. I guess I can tell you that the total cost of the six contracts in this biennium, in terms of additional new money, is about $80 million. That includes, however, the nurses for around, I think it's $7 million, and the law enforcement of about another $7 million. The remainder would be the various MNSCU contracts. The total increase in costs biennium to biennium of all the contracts is 6.44%. And this is for the contract period that's ending this June 30th here in 2015. And so this was for the contract period of July 1st, 2013 through June 30th, 2015. And the way we do contracts around here, you know, oftentimes we end up ratifying them after the start date's already happened. In this case, in particular, it's gotten to be kind of late because they weren't actually ratified because of arbitration by the LCC Commission until last fall sometime. With that, members, I think maybe it's best if I just stand for any questions.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Knobloch, I am wondering if there's any way to speed up the process, or, you know, what is the status of the next series of contract negotiations, and what is the likelihood of completing those prior to just right before the end of the period that they're covering?
Representative Knobloch?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, I think that, yeah, in some ways it would seem like that's the way it ought to work, and I guess I'm not really an expert on the whole contracts area. It would seem like we ought to settle them before they start. I would say the likelihood of that happening this year, unless something really changes, is probably zero, because that would mean having them settled before this July 1st. But I think there have only been the most preliminary discussions that have started, probably in part because the previous contract hasn't even yet been ratified. But I would agree that I think in a perfect world, we probably should look at changing the ratification process that we have so that we aren't faced with doing something like we're being asked to do today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Grundhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, just a follow-up comment to Representative Pugh's question. When I was on the school board, we had a penalty imposed by the state if we weren't settled by a certain date. I think it was $25 per student, and that did facilitate early settlement of contracts. So if you put a little penalty on not settling the contract sooner, it seems like it gets done much faster, okay? But being that as it may, my question is the $80 million just in general within the funding provided by the state? I know that in some of these cases, there's also, you know, MNSCU and some of these other cases, there's additional money that, you know, comes in besides from the state. But my concern is we settle these contracts and then they come back and they want additional money because they settled the contracts over and above what their available funding is, and it seems to be a habitual problem where state and government money shows up. So could you respond to that, Representative
Knobloch?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Grundhagen. The money that MNSCU was allocated with the last legislature goes toward paying this. There isn't any specific line item that I'm aware of that the last legislature put in saying this is for additional salary costs. Really, the understanding sort of is that the universities are going to make it work. The colleges are going to make it work. I know if you look at the governor's supplemental budget, for example, you'll see I don't think with MinSCU, because in his last supplemental budget he didn't have anything for MinSCU yet, although the rumors are that there's going to be something in there now for the next one. But he often, for other agencies in this last budget, had a additional salary supplement saying, you know, we want to give this agency X many million dollars because of the expected salary increases they'll have to absorb. But we don't have anything like that that I'm aware of that was put into law for this biennium. And, of course, this biennium that the contract covers is almost over, so it's almost an irrelevant issue for this particular contract.
Chair. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Knobloch, for that response. Do you know by category what the percent increase is on the different settlements, benefits and salary?
When you say by category, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, when you say by category, do you mean by contract?
Yeah, by contract.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, the... I got to look carefully here. The print on this is really small, but the Minnesota nurses, I believe, are 4.85%. The Minnesota Law Enforcement Association is 4.9%. The State University that's not the biennial increase. I think the more important number is the total compensation increase biennium that includes insurance and things like that. And I guess the average, as I said before, is 6.44% for all six of the contracts. And they basically run, the lowest one is the personnel plan for the administrators is 5%. The highest one is the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association, 7.21%. IFO 6.35%, Association of Administrators and Service Faculty 6.33%, and State College Faculty 6.55%.
Representative Gruenhagen, anything further?
I was trying to help with the question.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm getting help from all kinds of areas here.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, one thing I should mention is that, you know, while these are, I guess maybe in some people's minds, you know, a fair bit more than the cost of living right now. If you go back 4 years before this contract, pretty much all the MinSCU organizations, unions, they received an increase the year before this, and then there were 3 years where they received no increase, 0, 0, 0, as they dealt with the effects of the recession and the budget deficit that we have. And so in some ways I think that they are catching up a bit from where they were.
Okay. Representative Gruenhagen, you have one more question.
Yeah, one more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response, Representative Knobloch. You know, I was chief negotiator for a number of years at our school district, and the thing is that our staff was paid at or above conference average, okay? So when we had the money, I was willing to pay people for doing a good job. And I don't want to keep people down, especially in government. But on the other hand, there has to be a balance between, what government allows as far as increases versus the private sector. And I know this has been shared on the House floor, and I don't have it with me today, but I think from... And this off the top of my head, the last 5-6 years, the average Minnesotan's income has decreased by about $4,000. And yet government, we keep handing out increases. And I just think there needs to be a balance there between what's happening to all Minnesotans versus what government. Because obviously, the average Minnesotans are paying the bill for government. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other? I have two other names on the list here, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gruenhagen, how many years were you on the school board?
Wait, you're on the school board?
16. No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, 8%. The household income has been down 8% since the Great Recession. So just a question for Representative Knobloch, and it's really not germane to your bill, but I'm going to throw it out there because I'm not going to speak again the rest of the day. I see that we're going to say goodbye to MinSCU, so can we call it MinSCU anymore? I wonder if you know how much money was spent on the study that was done by the consultants to rename MinSKU. If you're not aware, they're going to change the name MinSKU to Minnesota State. And some folks in Mankato and Winona aren't too happy about that. Maybe Representative Pawlowski knows about that. But can we call it MinSKU anymore and open for discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, in the spirit of the day, I might ask you something about snakes in Ireland. We were talking about that on the House floor. But I guess I have vaguely heard something about the subject that you're talking about, but I really don't know anything more about it than that. If there's some action that has been taken, I guess I'm not aware of that. So I really don't know.
Good question, I guess. Oh. So we'll hear more about that as time goes on. If you want my opinion, I don't necessarily take lightly the name changes. You know, if you get used to something, and it'll be MinSKU for a long time if they're going to change it. It's still MinSKU to me. So, let's see. Representative Lean, you've got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess more of a comment, and I think it's worth noting that, you know, going back over the last couple of years, taking a look at these contracts and some of the shortfalls at MinSKU, you know, I think it's important for us to take a look at their enrollment projections and what enrollment ended up being in terms of anticipated tuition dollars that would come in. And so as we take a look at putting the omnibus budget together for the Office of Higher Ed, the two systems, U of M, MinSKU, I think that's certainly worth noting. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Isaacson.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to offer a correction to the household income changes. The numbers given prior were not correct in the sense that we are still steadily above the national average and quite in line with the rest of the state where we were in 2008. So thank you.
All right. Anything else? I think we're out of questions. Representative Knobloch, thank you very much, and we'll renew the motion that House File 488 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you very much. And we need a vote on that. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Unanimous.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right, next bill on the agenda, House File 1306. Representative Bernardi, welcome. You're right at home here, but we still have to welcome you anyway. But,
thank you.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 1306 to be possible inclusion. I mean, how would you like to be a possible inclusion into the omnibus higher education?
It'll be laid over bill? For possible inclusion. Okay. That's correct.
Thank you.
So, you can go ahead and present
you.
Your bill.
Okay, I'd like to get my bill in proper format, and that would be I'd like to move House File, 1306 A1 amendment. And it doesn't change the substance of the bill, it just clearly articulates that it includes concurrent enrollment.
Okay, that's the A1 amendment?
Yes.
Members, we're going to vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is
adopted. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask if we could suspend the rules and do an oral amendment. And it's similar to the last amendment, but what it would do is after the word of in on 2.15, we would insert an international baccalaureate course, comma, or, and then it would go on. The intent of this bill was also to address the transferring of international baccalaureate courses as well.
Everyone have that? We can just go ahead and vote on that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I guess someone, could you repeat that one more?
Okay, so on line 2.15 of the bill, it, after the word of, so required grade of the goal area or competency requirement as part of right after that word of, we would insert an international baccalaureate course, comma, or.
Everyone have it? We can go ahead and vote on that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All together?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? All right, that's done. A little
punchy. Okay, thank you so much. This bill is before you. It's one of those bills to, I think of it as a bill to help students and also help get students out of college as quickly as possible and get them graduating within 4 years. And addressing the bureaucracy and challenges students face, I think, is an important thing we can do as legislators to get the barriers removed. And the bill before you is a policy, actually, most of it's in policy already at MNSCU that is regarding Minnesota transfer curriculum. This was brought to me by my school districts as they were having problems with students actually getting their courses that they took in high school accepted in the MNSCU system. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, someone's told no and they just give up. And, you know, people that have tenacity, they might keep at it or those sorts of things. But we shouldn't make it hard for a student to get these things transferred. And so I want to just read, I'll tell you about the bill in particular. I got comments from MNSCU, and basically it's very similar to their policy now. The difference is when I use state, I think I talked with Stacy Stout about this too, state, college, and university. That's how we tend to think of it as. In their policy, they use the word system, so that's just one minor change. And then they go on to tell me in the comments that current policy, current practice, we have policy, system policy procedures already do this, the transfer curriculum provides this, and it's a system policy and procedure. And it continues on to say that in a number of places. The one area that is the reason why I'm writing this bill is that it had been that there's current practice, however, will ensure all system colleges and universities are transcripting PSEO courses correctly. So what has happened is it's their intent to do it, but it's been brought to their attention. I don't know if it was after I brought it to their attention or what, but they have found out that it was brought to our attention that a few of our colleges and our universities may not be transcripting PSEO courses correctly. So we plan to ensure that they do so to avoid incorrect transfer of these courses. The vast majority of our colleges and universities currently transfer PSEO courses correctly. Once we correct the transcripting issue, all PSEO courses should transfer as they should. So that's I'm sharing with you how this bill is very similar to their current policy. I've talked with my school districts about it, and they felt it was very important that we actually get it into state statute. So I'm moving forward with that. My superintendents, one is recovering from surgery this week. You know, what a way to spend a spring break, but, you know, that's hard to, someone who's very dedicated does that on their spring break. And then my other superintendent wasn't able to make it, and she shares these comments. She said that it's been several years of discussion with MNSCU schools that we have had seen the inconsistency among MNSCU institutions as they determine the transfer curriculum goals for courses, either concurrent enrollment courses or international baccalaureate IB diploma courses. Currently, each institution determines the goals and competency requirements from the transfer curriculum list of common general education goals. This means that for some courses, IB diploma courses or concurrent enrollment courses, students may receive different goals or competencies depending on the institution. With college and career readiness as a focus for school district, it doesn't make sense for students who are taking the same college and career readiness courses may end up with different goals and competencies completed depending on which MNSCU institution they apply to attend. This bill established consistency and that students' work is recognized consistently rather than having the students, oftentimes at Fridley High School, a first-generation student who go to college, maneuvering a system that seems unnecessarily burdensome. This bill strengthens the opportunities for students and families to meet the goals and competencies and enable them a well-defined and articulated path to post-secondary success. So I think that gives you a bit of background of the need for this bill, and I really appreciate you hearing the bill. I think it would really help our students and make it easier for them to navigate through the system and be successful in their college career.
All right, thank you. Questions? Any other have any?
Nope.
No one testifying? Anyone in the audience who would like to testify? Well, they had a chance. Very well done.
Oh, thank you much, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1306 it be laid over and considered to be put in the Higher Education Omnibus Bill. Okay.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next, Representative O'Neill, House File 551. Representative O'Neill, would you like to, first of all, move your bill?
I would. Thank you. I'd like to move House File 551 to be passed and referred to the Committee Greater Minnesota Economic Workforce Development Policy Committee.
That's correct.
Okay, and I also have an amendment.
All right.
I'd like to move the amendment and then talk about the bill as a whole. I'd like to move the DE4.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I've got it. Okay. Is it the lead all?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd like to move the DE4. And I'd like to just talk about the bill as a whole after we move the DE4.
Okay. All those in favor of the DE4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. I mean, proceed.
Thank you, Chair. And I do have six testifiers here, so I'm just going to briefly introduce the bill, but then I'm going to turn it over to the testifiers because it's a pretty comprehensive bill with a lot of moving parts and a lot of moving people. And before I do that, though, I'd actually like to thank some of the members of the committee that had a lot of influence and kind of worked alongside of me to do this. Representative Isaacson on the committee, he and I worked very hard on this bill. With the agencies, with MNSCU, with the chamber, with business, with industry, and of course, Representative Norton, thank you so much for all of your work on this. And we took your suggestions, and I know you had a lot to do with the pipeline project, so I definitely want to acknowledge your work on that as well. So this bill, like I said, is a collaborative effort between industry experts, employers, higher ed institutions, labor, to define competency standards. And what this bill does is it takes the pipeline project, which Dolly will come and talk about that in just a minute, and turns it into action. So that's something I really enjoy doing, is taking concept and turning it into action. What House File 551 does is it establishes a dual training grant program, which will be administered by DEED. Employers can apply to the grant program to train their employees in occupations which have been identified by the pipeline project, which we will hear from Dolly in a few minutes. And those are areas that are high growth and high wage. And those areas that have been identified in the pipeline project in a larger sense are advanced manufacturing, healthcare, IT, and ag. And so Dolly will come and talk about that, and then I'll get into some more of the components of the bill. But if we could have Jessica Lumen come, and she's going to give you a little bit of background. And if we miss something, Representative Norton, let us know. Representative Norton was there on many, many of those meetings, maybe all the meetings, maybe even, yes, most of them. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, please, and then we'll move on through the bill.
Welcome. Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
And yes, then, thank you, Mr. Seat. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Lumen, and I serve as the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. I'm pleased to be able to present the progress report on a project that we have been working on at DLI since July. We think a lot of work has been done since July, and we're very proud of the progress so far. All of you should have the report, hopefully, in front of you. The report is also available, the full report is available on our website for all of those who would like to take a look at it. And I first want to start by thanking the incredibly hard work of our project team, the support of the legislative authors, Senator Bonoff and Representative Norton, on the pipeline project. Also our partners at DEED, MinSCU, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, AFL-CIO, and the participation of over 200 industry leaders. And we've been able to really put together what we hope is a really good start to a competency standard program for the state of Minnesota in four key industries. A lot of the people that worked on this project are in the room today, and again, I would like to thank them all for their very hard work. The pipeline project is based on the success of registered apprenticeship that we've seen in this state, in this country, and around the world for centuries. The Department of Labor and Industry is the state administrative authority for registered apprenticeship for the United States. Currently, there are over 9,000 registered apprentices in Minnesota successfully completing apprenticeship programs in the construction industry, manufacturing, utilities, and healthcare. The pipeline project took the experience that we've had in registered apprenticeship and really leveraged it to look at a broader dual training model for workforce in four industries, and as Representative O'Neill said, those are healthcare services, information technology, advanced manufacturing, and agriculture. Just to explain, dual training is a little bit less formal than registered apprenticeship, and it's not currently regulated by the state. As I said, DLI regulates registered apprenticeship programs. Dual training is a model that is really just has three components, which is employment, related technical instruction, and on-the-job training. A person would start in a job, and while they're learning their skills, they would be both getting classroom training and mentorship and on-the-job training at that employer. In order for the pipeline project to explore this dual training model, we had to first convene industry councils. And these included industry experts, subject matter experts, employers, higher education institutions, and representatives of workers from all over the state. We had about 50 participants in each industry council. And these groups, over the time from August through November of last year, were really able to do four things. We were able to explore the dual training concept. We were able to identify up to four occupations in each of these industries that the industry councils thought would be conducive to the dual training model of employment, on-the-job training, related instruction. We were beginning to define the competencies that are necessary for each of these occupations, and that's what the next steps of this process are. And we were also starting to develop dual training programs and support existing apprenticeship programs for the occupations identified by the industry councils. The pipeline progress report has really seven recommendations that I'd like to share with you. And those are all in the executive summary of the report. And I just briefly want to go through. The first recommendation is to complete the occupational competency standard work for all of the occupations identified in the pipeline project. What this means is when the industry all agrees what it means to be competent in an occupation, then the industry can be able to train to a set standard of skills. Knowledge, ability, and then it becomes transferable throughout the industry. And this is what's really important about competency standards and what really works for registered apprenticeship is that if you have graduated from a registered apprenticeship program as a carpenter, everybody in the construction industry knows what that means. We're trying to create similar competency expectations for these four industries. The industry experts have begun to develop and validate occupational specific competency standards. We are using U.S. Department of Labor models that have already been developed, so we didn't have to start from scratch. There's lots of great work happening in this area nationally and internationally. And I'm happy to report that as of today, which is post our report that we submitted to the legislature in January, as of March, we now have models for all 15 of the occupations that were identified in the pipeline project. We are convening what we're calling competency councils to validate and make sure that those are the right competencies, and then we will also use the industry groups in order to approve those, again, to reach consensus among the industry as to what the competency standards could and should be for those occupations. Recommendation number two from the pipeline report is to build those competency councils for each of the targeted industries. to develop the additional occupations. So we were using the competency councils now to look at the first 15 that were identified in the pipeline project, and then we would use these same industry councils to continue to identify additional occupations in each of those industries that are conducive or suited to a dual training model. One of the things that we heard loud and clear from a lot of the participants in our industry council meetings was that, yeah, we'll start with these three or four for our industry, but we have so much more demand and so much more need, and there will be more coming through the competency councils to help. Once we've got the really good process developed for developing and validating competencies, how we can then go forward with different and more occupations. Recommendation number three is to establish dual training committees for at least one pipeline project identified occupation in each target industry. What this means is this is taking those competencies and actually creating a training program based on those. And we're hoping that we can do at least one of those in each industry by the end of June. That might be a little ambitious for us, but we're trying really hard. Recommendation four is to develop templates and implementation tools for dual training programs for all of the occupations identified. This is really creating the infrastructure so that people can take these tools and then use them in their industry associations and in their as employers. How-to guides, toolkits, just the tools that people need in order to really develop dual training programs. Recommendation number five is create and execute a plan for dual training outreach, development, and awareness. You'll see that this in the proposals. Is one of the things that we did hear from industry, I know you hear all the time as well, is how do we get more blank interested in our occupations, interested in our jobs? How do we get more young people, people of color, veterans, women, whatever the real need is in the industry to continue to increase interest in and get people excited about the occupations? That's one of the things that we really want to be able to support through this project. Recommendation six, align dual training delivery systems to other workforce initiatives. We really see registered apprenticeship as well as the pipeline project as workforce development programs. This is really investing in the future workforce as well as the current workforce. And we want to make sure that we're not duplicating efforts, but that we're really leveraging and aligning all of the efforts related to occupational development for these industries with this project. And recommendation number seven is to develop research and analysis tools to determine the dual training costs and benefits for employers, employees, and the state. And this is to help us tell the story of dual training and also so that we can really gauge success. And then finally, the last recommendation, which is recommendation number eight, is explore providing financial support to make dual training programs both viable and sustainable for employers and employees. And I know that's something that the legislature is absolutely looking at. We have been so proud and excited to be a part of this project. We at DLI continue to support the expansion of dual training and registered apprenticeship programs throughout the state. We serve as both a resource and a regulator for registered apprenticeship programs, and we believe we've made a good start on this important project to help Minnesota's skilled workforce be developed in these four critical industries. I want to thank all of the employers, industry representatives, legislators, labor representatives, and state agencies that have given their time, energy, and effort for this project. And there's more to come as we finish this up through the rest of the Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Luman. Any questions of Ms. Luman? You have more testifiers?
Yes, I have much more. Much more to come. I just wanted to say as we have Deed coming up, thank you. As Deed comes up, I just wanted to explain kind of how this is kind of contained. And so the grant is not available if it's not, if the competency has not been completed. And so we really want to follow this procedure through it. And I really want to thank Representative Norton because that was something that was really important to her as well, to make sure that we have six competencies done, 15 are almost done. And so once those 15 competencies are done and we actually know and can define, well, what is a machinist and how can you take, you know, just like what's a carpenter? Everybody knows what a carpenter is and the skills, or what's an electrician or what's a plumber. We want to do the same thing in these four industries across advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, and IT. And so we want to take that concept. We don't want to jump ahead. So I just want to make it clear that the grants are available after those competencies have been completed. Another component that's really important to understand, too, is that there needs to be a contract between the employer and the employee so that they have an understanding as to what they're going to be doing, what the expectations are, if the employer is going to be putting in some money. Does that employee have to have some skin in the game as well? Do they need to have a certain length of stay that they, I mean, that's totally up to the employer and the employee, but there needs to be some sort of an understanding. After that understanding is done, then they can move forward in the grant process. So I just want to start with that and then have Kim talk about what is Deed's role in administrating the grants.
Welcome. State your name, please, and then we'll get.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Kim Babine. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at Deed. Thank you to Representative O'Neill and others who have worked on this project, Representative Isaacson, Representative Norton. Deed is happy to be a part of this, and really the foundation for this effort is exactly what you just heard from the work that's been done at Dolly. Deed has been a partner in that, but the heavy lifting, all the work is Dolly. They deserve the credit, and we are excited about these competency standards. We think that it is really moving the ball on the type of training that we do, the type of workforce development that we do. So there is a lot to build on there. So the bill really has two parts. The second part is what you heard about. It's to continue that competency standard work, and there is a lot of good to come, as you heard from those recommendations. The first part of the bill is a grant program that Deed would administer to, as Representative O'Neill mentioned, to employers who are working with employees to complete these competencies, the training around these competencies. So Deed, as hopefully you know, we're always looking at different ways to address job training and workforce development needs across the state. It's really our mission to make sure that we are making, that we are preparing individuals, that there are trained workers available to meet the needs of businesses across the state. We are always looking to be responsive to the changes that are happening across the state and looking at new approaches for how to accomplish this goal. While the program presented here isn't in the governor's budget, the governor and Deed, of course, are committed to job training and workforce development to meet the needs of employers, and especially with this idea of making sure that we have trained employers. We're looking at this proposal in light of a number of other proposals in front of the legislature and in light of some of our current programs at Deed. We know that there are a need for a variety of tools in the tools to meet the training needs of our state. We want to be responsible with taxpayer dollars and make sure that we don't have redundancy in our programs, and we're open to looking at changes that can be made to existing programs to accommodate new approaches if it's applicable. We're very happy to be part of this. Thank you to Representative O'Neill, and look forward to working together moving forward.
Thank you, Ms. Bobine. Any questions of the testifier? You did a good job. Thank you very much.
Okay, and I'll just add a few more points along the way as we have a couple of people from MnSKU come down to kind of explain how that. This is a complicated bill, so we've got a lot of moving pieces. So as MnSKU comes down. The employer portion, I just wanted to talk about briefly. The employers do have skin in the game, and for those companies that are over $50 million, they'll be asked to put in 66% towards the grant. So let me just back up just a second. So once this contract is done and the employer, they find a place that works within the MnSKU system to get training, then that student would apply for state and federal grants. After that, grants have been given, then the portion left over would be the grant amount. The employer, so this is the scale for the employer. So anything over $50 million would be a 66%, and that's the same as Job Skills Partnership. So that's why we started at 66%. Between 20 and 50 million, it would be 50%. Between 10 and 20 million, it would be 33%. And any business with gross revenue of under 10 million, it would be 20%. And so it's scaled back to really help the small businesses as well. And with that, I'm just going to turn it over to the MnSKU folks and kind of let them explain to you sort of how this would work. And we have a great kind of roadmap that we've already done, so this is exciting to just build on that.
Thank you, Representative.
State your name and proceed.
Yep, Chair Nornes. My name is Joe Mulford. I'm the Minnesota State College University System Director for Education and Industry Partnerships. And I'd like to introduce my colleague, Mike McGee.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Mike McGee. I'm Dean of Manufacturing, Math, and Science at Hennepin Technical College.
Okay, Mr. Mulford, you want to begin?
Thank you. And again, I want to thank Representative O'Neill for allowing us to be a part of the conversation as this work was being done. And as I mentioned, I work on industry partnerships for the Minnesota State College University system, and I want to speak today in support of House File 551 and specifically to the benefit of in support of the incumbent workforce that we deal quite a bit with. I think that the bill serves in a couple capacities or serves those incumbent workers in a couple capacities. It's a direct benefit to both the employees and to the employers in developing a competitive workforce. One of the things that is my opinion that it does for the workers in those organizations that would participate is creates an opportunity for upward mobility. And one of the things that we've seen with employers is, and there's been a lot of discussion around finding the right skills, not just finding the right, finding people, but finding the people with the right skills. And we feel like this is an opportunity to work with those businesses and helping them kind of grow their own and part through a partnership. I think that, if enacted, the bill would be supported by a historically significant component of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system. Last year alone, our system served approximately 163,000 people through our customized training and continuing education divisions. We served and completed work on approximately 3,200 contract training, customized training programs with businesses and different organizations in Minnesota. So it's a significant amount of effort that we work with each year, and so the capacity is definitely there to serve if this bill was enacted. Speaking a little bit about dual training models, we know that they're a proven learning model, and in my opinion, they're most powerful when conducted in alignment with a higher education institution that aligns the efforts with the employers, with the employees, and the work that's being done on our campuses in certificates, diplomas, and degrees. This program does support that type of alignment, and I think it does it very wisely. The bill allows for the retention of the learning experience and the materials that might be developed during those experiences in the public higher education system. So I think what it gives the opportunity to do is not have to continue to do research and development or develop a bunch of new models, but through the public higher education system, we could become a repository for that investment that's made by the legislature and the taxpayers in Minnesota. Just one example of this kind of effort that we've undertaken in recent years was actually came under House File 729 that was enacted in 2013. It was a customized training pilot program. It was a dual training model that was done. It was a pilot intentionally done at that time, and it supported four pilot programs in our system that worked on developing learning models, again, in support of both employees and the employers that participated. I'd like to now introduce a colleague, Mike McGee, who introduced himself earlier, to share some of the basic insights from that particular project and overall about the value of dual training models in his experience. Mike's the Dean of Manufacturing at our largest standalone technical college, Hennepin Technical College. He oversaw the customized training pilot program when it was started at Hennepin Technical College and works closely with many different businesses in that region. So I'd like to turn it over to Mike.
Thanks, Joe.
Mr. McGee, state your name again for the record.
Sure. Mike McGee. I'm an academic dean at Hennepin Technical College. And just quickly, by way of background, 28 years in public higher education, so I actually predate the Minsky system. I started in 1987 as a faculty member at Normandale. I want to thank Representative O'Neill for your support for manufacturing education. She was kind enough to come by Hennepin Technical College last fall and witness firsthand the labs and classrooms where we deliver technical education to over 1,000 students in manufacturing alone. So we have the prowess and the capability to keep a good supply of trained, skilled workers to the lifeblood in Minnesota, which is manufacturing. We also appreciate the alternative funding streams, and as Joe said, we did benefit from Representative Isaacson's bill. There were four schools named in that bill 2 years ago that provided some customized training funds to support high-wage, high-demand, high-tech careers. And really what it did for us is build capacity. It wasn't a lot of money at the time, but it came at the right time because we had a brand new program in quality assurance for manufacturing, the only one of its kind in the region. Quality assurance is metrology, the science of measuring, which goes to the quality output in manufacturing, and that's a critical component of the manufacturing process. So those dollars that that bill provided, coupled with some other federal money we had, allowed us to enroll students in that program and provide critical skilled employees to the manufacturing industry. And that was really great news for manufacturing to see this program come into fruition. So we're building stronger connections to industry partners with this capacity building, and a bill like Representative O'Neill's would help us to target these high-tech, high-wage, high-demand areas where there's additional training necessary to bring employees up in an organization, because as they promote in an organization, it opens more entry-level positions and creates that continuous pathway to good, solid careers. The technical skills attainment piece of that, in other words, tying this to industry standards, I think is really key. It's valuable for students to be able to walk away from our education, training, and career pathways with more than just degrees or diplomas, but also industry certifications like NIMS, the National Institute of Metalworking Standards, which is something that we're invested in as well. So dual training is workplace-based experiences and formal education and training. It's that triad of opportunity for people that a bill like this would support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGee. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I had actually forgotten that I had gone there. I have I travel a lot of places, and now that you bring that up, that was one of my favorite places to go up in that area, and both North Hennepin Community College and then Hennepin Technical. And just to see everything that you're doing there, and from the welding to the CNC to all of that was quite enlightening. And it just kind of comes full circle with all the work that we do in the interim, and that's why a lot of us do the work that we do when we're not in session. So I appreciate you saying that, and I'm just getting really excited. The more you all talk about this, I'm just getting really excited about launching this. So with that, I'd love to bring up the chamber. Thank you both very much. I'll come back and see you again.
Yeah, you
okay.
Before they leave, any questions of the committee, of the two? We can always call them back, I guess. So the next person on deck. The next two people on deck.
Yes, we've got Sarah from the chamber, and then we actually have someone from 3M. So
okay.
We've got some big attention here. That's exciting.
Who's going first? Ladies first. Can you state your name, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Radosovich with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We testified last year in support of the bill that began the pipeline project, and now this is called Earn While You Learn. And we've been engaged in the stakeholder convenings with the Department of Labor and Industry and businesses over the past year. We support House File 551 because, quite simply, our members have a hard time finding skilled workers. Many of the jobs sitting open require a two-year technical degree or a certificate. Across industries, we hear that well-paying job openings get few or no qualified applicants. And employers tell us things like, not every student needs a four-year degree. These concerns have only gotten louder and more pressing over the past 10 years. For many employers, we are now in a new hiring environment, one in which you can't just post a job opportunity and expect to get qualified applicants, a method that some have referred to as post and pray. Instead, it's an environment in which a business has to be actively involved in finding, recruiting, and training its own workforce. Some companies have dual training programs already. They hire entry-level workers with the understanding that those individuals will work and pursue related education at the same time to then fill in roles that require some more education that the company has a hard time filling. House File 551 would help more employers try this approach, which is important because it requires more upfront investment than they might be used to. three quick details that I want to touch on just quickly. One, a strength of this bill is that it's very targeted. It's focused on four high-demand industries, as you heard, agriculture, IT, healthcare, and manufacturing. And within that, it's focused on specific occupations that are likely to grow or that have workforce shortages. Second, we think it's very important that this bill asks the Department of Labor and Industry, to the extent possible, to identify existing competency standards and only establish them, establish new ones, essentially, where there are insufficient existing national and international standards to work from. The goal is to produce workers for the entire industry, not workers customized for individual companies. So to do that, it's important to work from widely recognized standards whenever possible, and this bill does that. Third, I just want to point out that we're supportive of the requirement for employers to have some skin in the game in training these employees. Employers have to put up at least a minimum percentage of the cost of the education, depending on their size in terms of revenue. And so this is a program that really helps employers who are already willing to make a significant investment. Overall, this is a great pilot effort that could help grow a promising practice in industries that face significant workforce challenges. I want to thank Representative O'Neill and Representatives Isaacson and Norton for all of your work on this bill and engagement over the past year. And thank you, members, for the chance to speak on its behalf. And I'll turn it over to Doug Stang from 3M.
Former Representative Doug Stang. For this committee, I'd like to also just remind them you were the chair of this committee one time.
Long time ago.
Long time ago. Yeah. I was just a young guy. So were you.
Yeah. I had a lot more hair, too. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
State your name. You know how it goes.
Yes. Yeah. Doug Stang, 3M. I oversee state government affairs for 3M. And we want to thank Representative O'Neill and all the others who have been involved in this legislation. We think this is a very worthwhile an exciting opportunity for the state. When people think of 3M in Minnesota, they think of our headquarters, but they often overlook the manufacturing presence that we have in the state. As far as a footprint, this is probably our most concentrated footprint in the world in terms of manufacturing facilities. We have facilities in Cottage Grove, Eagan, Fairmont, New Ulm, Alexandria, Hutchinson, Staples. We have a large manufacturing footprint. And one of the greatest challenges we have to those jobs in those manufacturing facilities is the ability to fill those positions. And we all know we've had the discussions over the year about how the face of manufacturing has changed, but we still have to convince younger high school students that it's not the greasy, grimy job that they may have thought it was, or they see old videos and TV shows and whatnot, that these are facilities where it is very high-tech, they're highly skilled workers that we need, and finding those folks to fill those jobs is a challenge. The nice part is that if you can tap into folks in Hutchinson and Alexandria and you can show them that they can get a great job in their small community, stay there, and live a great life at a decent wage with great benefits. So there's many upside, but a lot of it is just informing the students that those opportunities exist. We're excited about this, and we think actually if this is successful here in Minnesota, we have manufacturing across the United States. We hope other states are going to model this because the competency standards are something else that we're very supportive of, that we know that we can hire folks who have those standards, who have a sufficient level of skills in place when they come work in our facilities is a huge advantage for the state and keeping those manufacturing jobs here in Minnesota. So we're excited about this. We appreciate the opportunity to express our support. We look forward to working with the authors to continue to help move it forward and try to be of any help and assistance that we can, because we think this is a great, great opportunity to move us forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Stang. Representative O'Neill, that's your witness list?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know. There's probably no one else that wants to. You've had good presentations, so there's probably no one else in the audience that wants to follow that, but we invite them down if they do. Otherwise, questions from the committee? Very thorough.
Representative Isaacson would like to say a word.
Oh, certainly we'll let him do that. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. I am very pleased to see the leadership that Representative Neal has put forth on this and all the partners playing involved. This has been a passion from my first term working on this issue and trying to tread some ground in getting us through so we can have this kind of a pipeline project. And so I'm really excited to be a part of it, and I appreciate the shout-out to my bill last year, which was trying to start that process, and another bill I'll have coming forth this year, piggybacking on that I often refer to as the little brother bill to the one we're hearing right now. So I'm very excited about it, and I think it has a lot of potential. And I really wanted to say one other thing. It has been unbelievably refreshing to have this kind of interplay with my opposition party, in the sense that we've been really, the politics has stayed out of it, and it's been, in my mind, my closest experience to the ideal version of what legislating would be like if we didn't have the politics involved, because everybody's just working on a common goal to make something better. And I just think that's a real compliment to many people I'm dealing with, both not only in the legislature, but outside of it in the private sector. So I really appreciate that, and it's been a wonderful experience so far. Thank you.
Good that you pointed that out. We all agree with that, I believe. Representative O'Neill, anything more you'd like to add?
I'm just very excited. The more we hear the testimony, I'm just so excited to launch this new project and this this bill be seen to be put into law. And you know, I hope we can have some more authors come on board. I hope, you know, the few that had offered quite a bit of suggestion along the way will come alongside and add their names as bill authors. So with that, I just would like to renew my motion if I could.
Yes, go ahead.
So I'd like to renew my motion. Let's see if I can find it again. It's renew my motion for House File 551 to be passed and re-referred to the Committee of Greater Minnesota Economic Workforce and Development Policy as amended.
All right, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And members, I think we are also done for the day. So the meeting is adjourned.